acting like this is inevitable, something seeming relaxed about infections going up. He added, people often want a generic psychological explanation, but we mustn't ignore the political and ideological context in which this is happening. We're looking at a phenomena of normalization. A powerful way of normalizing a situation is to explain it through natural phenomena, for instance, putting the ongoing spread of COVID down to the virulent properties of the Delta variant of the virus. According to Professor Stephen Reicher, a psychologist at the University of St Andrews in Scotland, the media also plays a role in setting a perception of what is normal. Research shows that the media changes virtually nobody's mind, adding, but it changes people's belief about what others think. The most recent surveys show that the public retains cautious attitudes on COVID safety. However, there is a widening gap between attitudes and behaviours. To some, the lack of public reaction to the ongoing death rate is bewildering. Kit Yates, a senior lecturer in mathematics at the University of Bath, said, it feels very surreal that we're just accepting the current infection rates. No one is making a fuss about it, but well over 100 people are dying every day due to COVID. Professor Kit Yates points out that while vaccination has changed the outcome of high COVID rates, having so much virus in circulation is not without consequence. He added, the current death rate is equivalent to over 40,000 people a year dying of COVID, and this is not normal. He concluded by saying, the government has abandoned all pretense at public health measures to control COVID. It's a national scandal, but one which seems to have largely slipped from view.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Military coups are yet again becoming a common occurrence in Africa. After recent military takeovers in Mali, Chad, and Guinea, it was the turn of Sudan. Last September, a group of Sudanese army officers purportedly loyal to deposed President Omar al-Bashir, led a failed military coup. Now, this is how the national TV announced the unsuccessful coup. Welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today, a program which gives you an alternative view on events taking place in Africa. Today, we are focusing on the alleged military coup in Sudan and the political and economic crisis in this country, which has also abandoned its long-term support for the Palestinian resistance. In today's show, we shall also look at how employees of the World Health Organization have been involved in sexual abuse in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Stay with us till the end of our show and let us know what you think by posting your comments on our social media pages.
Sudan's coup attempt and transition woes. Sudan's fragile transitional government says it foiled an attempted coup that was linked to the ousted regime of longtime ruler Omar al-Bashir. Following the coup, political leaders and army generals, who have always been at loggerheads, have now made their differences public for the first time since signing a power-sharing deal 2 years ago.
Sudanese Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok further claimed that the coup attempt sought to target the revolution's achievement, stressing that it was orchestrated by Paris from within and outside the Sudanese army. He said it was necessary to reform security institutions after the coup.
The failed coup attempt clearly indicates that it's necessary to reform the military and security apparatuses. It calls for an all-out reconsideration of the transition process and the necessity to forge a partnership based on the values and principles of the revolution towards a civil, democratic transition only.
Well, for an incisive analysis on the coup attempt in Sudan, we have contacted Abayomi Azikiwe, the editor of the Pan-African Newswire. He has traveled extensively in Africa conducting field research on political economy. Thanks a lot for your time, sir. Now, first, tell us what, in your opinion, was the reason behind the recent coup in Sudan?
Well, according to the government, there were people who were loyal to the former regime of President Bashir. There's questions about who was actually involved. They claim that 21 people were arrested in a plot to overthrow the government and perhaps reinstall President Omar Hassan al-Bashir. It's still not clear exactly the dynamics of the attempted coup. They claim it was centered in Abdurrahman, which is a twin city of Khartoum. So it looks like it was a power struggle, perhaps within the military apparatus of Sudan.
Well, some sources in Khartoum claim the recent failed coup, just like other reported attempts, had been fabricated by the current military rulers to win the sympathy of Western countries. Mr. Azikiwe, there have been unconfirmed reports that the recent coup in Sudan was actually fake and was planned by the military itself. Do you agree with this viewpoint?
No, I think there are definite differences within the military and also within the political apparatus that are part of the Sovereign Council, the Transitional Sovereign Council. I believe that there are sharp disagreements over fundamental issues involving the composition of a potential legislative council, the question of Sudanese relations with the United States, relations with the State of Israel, and also its relationship with some of the states that are heavily allied with the United States and Israel.
Mr. Abayomi Azikiwe of the Pan-African Newswire. Stay tuned for more.
Bitter recriminations followed the attempted military takeover in September. The facade of unity presented by both the civilian and military members of the Transitional Council has been wiped out. This has now thrown the future of Sudan's transition into deep uncertainty. Mohamed Al-Faki Suleiman, committee leader and member of the Joint Military-Civilian Sovereign Council, Sudan's highest authority, asked people to be prepared to return to street protests if necessary.
We will defend our government, our people, and the democratic transition to the last drop of blood. And if there is any threat to democratic transition, we will fill the streets and be at the forefront, as is our responsibility.
Is there a possibility that the current tensions might derail Sudan's transition to civilian rule and plunge the country into more chaos?
It could. They are not able to bring about a stable transitional dispensation. There's been no real date set for multi-party elections throughout the country. The government seems to be more preoccupied with pleasing Washington and Tel Aviv rather than actually looking out for the well-being of the nearly 60 million people that live in the Republic of Sudan. So they have to be concerned about the economic growth of the country. They have to be concerned about bringing a myriad of political parties and mass organizations, civil society organizations, into the political fold inside the country. They've been negotiating with these various rebel groups from Darfur and from the border areas. Some of them have committed to a political dispensation and others have not. So it's going to be a struggle going forward. in order to achieve real stability in Sudan.
The people of Sudan have suffered immensely following their country's separation from South Sudan. The armed insurrections in several parts of Sudan, especially South Kordofan, Darfur, and Blue Nile, have their roots in the decades of conflict between the Khartoum government and the southern regions, which ultimately led to the secession of South Sudan in 2011. The situation in the country is now getting worse since the overthrow of Omar al-Bashir in 2019.
Sudan has seen increased protests by angry masses over poor economic and political conditions. What's really happening in Sudan right now?
Perhaps it is the inability of the Transitional Sovereign Council to meet the needs of the Sudanese people. They have to, in fact, resolve these issues politically. They tried to link the protests in the eastern part of the country to the attempted coup that took place several weeks ago. Whether or not there's a direct link remains to be uncovered, but these are some of the dynamics that the Transitional Sovereign Council has to deal with. The interim Prime Minister, Abdallah Hamdok, is really at the mercy not only of the military in Sudan, but also the international forces of imperialism, which are dictating to him what his policy should be inside his own country.
Now, Western countries condemned the failed coup attempt in Sudan, expressing support for the transitional government, which is increasingly unpopular among the masses in the country.
We were expecting a speedy transition to civilian rule. We don't actually feel there is a transition to anything here yet. Today, there is no freedom, peace, or justice in Sudan.
Now, Mr. Azikiwe, do you think foreign powers are involved in the current political crisis in Sudan, especially by backing a regime which appears quite unpopular among the masses?
No question about it. The United States pressured Sudan under the previous government of President Donald Trump to normalize relations with Israel. They also required that they pay millions and millions of dollars in restitution for terrorist acts that were carried out. And there's no direct evidence that the previous Sudanese government was even involved in these acts. The bombing of the USS Cole in 2000, the bombing in 1998 of the U.S. embassies in Nairobi, Kenya, and Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. Yet, they made that a precondition of delisting Sudan as a state sponsor of terrorism. So this is an ongoing process. And even to date, despite all these measures that have been taken by interim Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok, the country is still suffering from food shortages, fuel shortages, high unemployment, and impoverishment.
Amid growing ties between the Khartoum Transitional Authority and the Israeli regime, Sudan's military rulers have confiscated and taken control of all assets that they claim to have provided backing for the Palestinian Islamic Resistance Movement Hamas on its soil. In response to the report, Hamas spokesman Sami Abu Zuhri rejected the claims of the Palestinian Resistance Movement's investment in Sudan. Why have the authorities in Sudan decided to take action against Hamas at this point in time?
According to sources inside of the Sudanese interim government, they were given a list by the United States of companies and organizations and institutions to close down and to seize their assets. And that's exactly what they have been doing. Over the last several months, they have shut down the resistance movement, Hamas, and they have seized assets which they claim belong to Hamas. But this is something, too, that's been engineered by Washington and Tel Aviv.
The normalization agreement between Khartoum and the Israeli regime provoked a furious backlash from the people in Sudan. Masses in Sudan have slammed as treacherous any ties with the Israeli regime. A resident of Khartoum here says normalization with Israel does not serve the interests of Sudan.
أنا بلدي دي بناسي بالسودانيين بالناس اللي فيها ممكن يختموا ونبقى أحسن من إسرائيل ونبقى أحسن من أمريكا ونبقى أحسن من الناس كلها لو تكاتفنا وحطينا يدنا مع بعض.
Now our last question to you. Clearly, the move by the regime in Sudan to seize Hamas-linked companies is a betrayal of the people of Palestine. What's your take on this?
It is a betrayal. Historically, the Republic of Sudan has been a close ally and supporter of the Palestinian Liberation Movement. In 1958, they passed the Israeli Boycott Act, which prohibited relations and economic interrelationships with the State of Israel. And now they have reversed this entire process. And it's been done largely through the interim government. There's been demonstrations in the country. A number of political parties have signed statements in opposition to this normalization with Israel. And I think the opposition is going to increase as the impact of these policies become clear to the Sudanese people.
Well, thanks a lot, Mr. Azikiwe, for your incisive analysis. Here at Africa Today, we shall keep you posted on the unfolding events in Sudan. We now take a short break before our next topic, which is about a sex abuse scandal facing World Health Organization workers in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Stay with us.
WHO scandal in the DRC.
Listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
An independent investigation commissioned by the World Health Organization has identified more than 80 alleged cases of sexual abuse during the Global Health Agency's response to an Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Now, the scandal has implicated at least 20 WHO staff members.
WHO staff knew of the allegations in early May 2019, but it wasn't until October 2020 that an independent commission was established. Although the commission was established in October 2020, it took investigators nearly 7 months to start interviews in Congo, where Ebola killed some 2,300 people in Ituri and North Kivu provinces between August 2018 and June 2020, the second deadliest outbreak ever.
Speaking during a media briefing by the independent commission that probed the scandal, WHO Director General apologized the victims.
The first thing I want to say is to the victims and survivors of the sexual exploitation and abuse described in the Commission's report. I'm sorry. I'm sorry for what was done to you by people who were employed by WHO to serve and protect you. I'm sorry for the ongoing suffering that this event must cause. I'm sorry that you have had to relieve them in talking to the Commission about your experiences. Thank you for your courage in doing so. What happened to you should never happen to anyone. It is inexcusable.
Now, to discuss the abuse scandal facing WHO employees in the Democratic Republic of Congo, we have contacted Edward Corrigan, an international human rights lawyer. Thanks a lot for your time. Now, our first question, what really went wrong and how was it possible that WHO staff abused people they were supposed to actually serve?
The problem is that it's a power imbalance. The people control the resources of almost unlimited power, and then you have women that are in a desperate social situation, many of them starving, and they would do anything to get jobs or to get food, or even, as one lady said, to get a basin of water just to clean herself. So that power imbalance is the root cause of the problem, and there weren't safeguards in place. The World Health Organization did have some training programs, but only a small percentage of people that were hired undertook the training.
Now, although the Commission recommended that reparations be considered for the victims, that's unlikely to happen in the UN system. The co-chair of the Independent Commission urged the WHO to consider compensating the victims.
Victims for the first reports of incidents until the completion of preliminary investigations. And finally, to also mandate this working group to reflect and make proposals on the possibilities of granting reparations to the victims at the end of duly initiated investigations, starting with the conclusions of the independent commissions in this case.
Now, Mr. Corrigan, do you think the WHO will act on recommendations of reparations or compensation to the victims of the abuse scandal?
I have seen no information to say that the WHO is going to pay reparations or compensation to the victims. However, I think this is something that they should do at a minimum in order to ameliorate the situation and to help these people overcome what had to be a traumatic experience. So I hope the WHO does provide compensation to the victims, because they're at fault because they did not properly screen the workers and they did not put training sessions in place, and they didn't protect their own employees and people that were volunteering or working with the WHO, and that is grounds for that they should pay for some sort of reparations and compensation.
The abuse scandal in the DRC raises serious questions about the WHO's top leaders and why they were unaware of the extent of the problem. The WHO Director General, for example, visited Congo 14 times during the Ebola response, while other staff made even more visits. This abuse scandal clearly points to deep flaws in international humanitarian operations. The WHO Director General has also admitted that the organization needs to regain the trust which has been dented by the Congo abuse scandal
and ensure more effective human resources processes. Already, we have taken several steps to improve our HR practices in recruitment, onboarding, induction, and training. We will also take steps to integrate standards of behavior relating to sexual exploitation and abuse in performance management, starting with leaders and managers.
How have these cases of sexual abuse affected the credibility of the WHO in the DRC and across the world in general?
This is definitely going to hurt them, and it also, I think, hurts some of the other organizations, including work from the United Nations and peacekeeping forces. And people should be aware that this problem is unfortunately quite common when you have such a power imbalance between the people who control resources and demand sex and those who are desperate to get some sort of employment, even food, water, whatever. And this is not going to help the WHO, but as I said, World Vision, UNICEF, other medical organizations, and certainly peacekeeping operations have experienced the same problem, and they should be aware of this, and they should take measures to safeguard the women and young girls and anybody else who is subject to exploitation and abuse.
The investigating commission recommended that WHO imposes disciplinary action on those who fail to report potential sexual exploitation and abuse incidents. Now, Mr. Corrigan, what other measures should WHO take to prevent such incidents from recurring in future?
Well, they have to send a strong message that if you rape people or you abuse your position, that you're going to be prosecuted to the full extent of the law. They also should have proper training sessions in place for people so that they're aware of these rules and regulations, and that they have to be sensitive to respecting the people that are working with them. And the WHO should have some sort of supervisory role and inspecting people, and also notify that if somebody is trying to exploit you or abuse you, that you should report this to the people who are running the operation so that they could take strong measures. The WHO tried to avoid these problems and get caught up in bureaucratic delays, and they also were overly concerned about whether or not these reports are in writing, that they're true. But they were trying to avoid dealing with this issue head on, but now that it's become public and they should be aware, this is unfortunately not an uncommon problem, and they should take strong measures to prevent it from ever happening again.
Thanks, Mr. Corrigan, for your input. We do hope that serious action will be taken to stop these wanton abuse of African people by these so-called international aid workers. Well, that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. Don't forget to drop us a line through our social media handle and let us know what you think about today's topics. God bless you.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
Making a biodegradable material strong enough to replace plastic is a tough task, but scientists are trying to do just that. We now present you an article written by Laura Patterson. The piece is titled "The Future of Plastic Alternatives." It comes from bacteria and goes back to bacteria. The article has been taken from the British newspaper The Guardian. When people think about plastic waste, they often think of the packaging that swaddles supermarket fruits and vegetables, shiny layers that are stripped away and thrown in the bin as soon as the produce is unloaded at home. It's a wasteful cycle that California-based company, Appeal, says it can help end. The firm has developed an edible, tasteless, and invisible plant-based spray for fruits and vegetables that works as a barrier to keep oxygen out and moisture in, increasing shelf life without the need for single-use plastic. It's currently being sprayed onto cucumbers and avocados at retailers, including Walmart. The CEO of Walmart, James Rogers, said, "We're showing that you can actually reimagine a food system that's not built on the foundation of single-use plastic." Appeal, which is valued at $2 billion as part of a wave of startups and scientific projects racing to develop materials that could help replace traditional single-use plastics. Their production methods and applications vary widely, but their stated aim is the same: to end the scourge of plastic waste. Since the 1950s, the world has produced an estimated 8.3 billion tons of plastics. Nearly two-thirds of which has ended up in landfill sites or leaching into soil, rivers, and oceans. Choking wildlife, plastics are a driver of the climate crisis. The vast majority are made from fossil fuels, and if global production continues on current trends, plastics may account for about 20% of oil consumption by mid-century. The problem is that fossil-based plastics are not easy to replace. Plastic is a wonder material, cheap to produce, lightweight, and incredibly durable. The latter is a great quality in use, but not when it ends up in a landfill site or the environment. Plastic can take centuries to degrade. Finding a material that is strong but can be essentially self-destruct when needed is incredibly tough. But plenty of scientists and companies are trying to do just that. Bioplastics have emerged as a popular alternative, even if they currently make up less than 1% of the market. Made from biosources such as sugarcane, algae, even banana waste, and shellfish, many pitch themselves as eliminating the need for fossil fuels and also breaking down easily after use. Sarah Kakadelis, a researcher in plastic pollution at Imperial College, University of London, said these green claims do not always stand up to scrutiny. If the raw material is not sourced sustainably, bioplastics could end up increasing deforestation to clear land and competing with food production. They also do not always break down as easily as advertised, sometimes taking years. And others require industrial composting facilities, which can be scarce. Some companies say they have cracked these problems. The Dutch biochemicals company Avantium, which has partnered with brands such as Carlsberg, has developed a 100% plant-based plastic made from sugars that can be used for bottles and firms. The company says its plastic is 100% recyclable, has a significantly lower carbon footprint than fossil-based plastics, and is sourced from sustainably grown plants. If this plastic falls out of the recycling stream, trials have shown that it takes about a year to decompose in an industrial composer. According to initial results from a long-term study with the University of Amsterdam, left in the environment, the plastic starts to degrade after a year. Avantium plans to open its first plant in 2023 in the Netherlands and predicts its packaging will be in supermarkets in just 3 years' time. Other companies are developing plastics that avoid the need for crops altogether. In September, the British-based biotech startup Shellworks launched a plastic made from microbes found in many maritime and soil environments. These feed on carbon sources, building up a fat-like energy storage system. Shellworks co-founder Amir Afshar said, "When his fat is extracted, it behaves exactly like plastic. The difference is, when it returns to nature, the same bacteria see it as food and start to eat it. Afshar said it comes from bacteria and then goes back to bacteria. The company has signed deals with beauty companies to work on products such as tubes, bottles and compacts, which often end up in landfill sites. Co-founder Insia Jafarji said, when people have finished with Shellworks products, they can be treated like food waste and composted with no special infrastructure needed. Other scientists are trying to turn plastic into a tool for tackling the climate crisis by making plastics from greenhouse gases. Kakadelis said, one could see in the future capturing carbon dioxide from the air and then using that to produce plastic. Scientists at Rutgers University have developed technology that can turn water and carbon dioxide into precursors for various plastics, which they say could replace PET and polyester fiber, ubiquitous in the fashion industry. About 60% of materials made into clothing is from plastics. Anders Lawson, the chief executive officer of Renew Carbon Dioxide, the startup spun out of Rutgers University research, said the method is essentially replicating nature's process for making oil and gas over millions of years, but doing so in a fraction of a second. The company hopes to harness the CO2 emitted from plastics as they decompose or are incinerated and use it to create new products. Renew Carbon Dioxide is building a pilot plant and expects to reach commercialization in 2025. Increasing consumer pushback on plastics has also led some companies to trial completely different materials. Mars and Unilever are experimenting with paper, which is widely recycled and less harmful than plastics if it ends up in the sea or at a landfill site. This summer, Coca-Cola begins testing a paper bottle in Hungary for one of its drinks, in partnership with Copenhagen-based startup Pabuco, which makes bottles from molded FSC-certified paper pulp. However, these bottles still have a plastic lid and are lined with a recycled PET plastic film, which keep the product from leaking or paper fibers from getting in. Pabuco's interim chief executive officer, Gitan Shield, said, our ultimate vision is to develop a fully bio-based paper bottle that can also be recyclable in the paper stream. Sander de Vreugde, who leads the New Plastics Economy Initiative at the Ellen MacArthur Foundation, said the big question for these innovations are, where is the material sourced from and where does it end up? For example, paper isn't a sustainable packaging material if it contributes to deforestation, or if the paper bottles and sweet wrappers don't make it into the recycling streams. It is also likely to take many years before these materials can scale up enough to make a dent in the 300 million tons of plastics recovered and produced every year. Mark Miodonic, professor of materials and society at University College London, worries about the proliferation of materials being developed without enough thought about how they fit into existing waste systems. He said, mostly what we want to do is actually make plastics that are very durable, and we want to keep them in the stream, so we want to recycle. Where he thinks biodegradability and compostability make sense are products such as caddy liners for food waste bins, tea bags. Why include the plastic that's going to last you 100 years into a tea bag? That's crazy. And hygiene products. Products with very short shelf lives could also suit compostable packaging. London-based Notplar makes plastic replacements from seaweed, a fast-growing carbon sequestering plant which breaks down anywhere within a few weeks. Co-founder Pierre Paslier said, "It's targeted at places where we pick something, we consume it, and it's over within minutes. And that's really where plastic is the worst material because it's going to be around forever." Notplar's edible Uho water bubbles were handed to runners at the 2019 London Marathon. It has also partnered with the delivery service Just Eat to provide compostable condiment sachets that can be put straight into the household food waste bins, and has developed a seaweed coating to replace the plastic lining on cardboard takeaway boxes. Sandra de Fruyt said materials innovation is one part of the puzzle, but truly dealing with plastic waste requires a hierarchy of action. Eliminate as much plastic as possible, then use recycled plastic. Finally, where virgin plastic are still required, use renewable feedstocks. He added, "It really needs to be done in that order." Myrdonic said scientists, engineers and companies may be tempted to look at plastic and say, "Let's swap it for another thing, and that's now solved." But the truth is, you have to redesign the whole system if you're going to solve the problem.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavik, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
In solidarity with the Palestinian inmates in Israeli jails, Palestinians held a demonstration in front of the Red Cross headquarters in the Gaza City, demanding an end to the recent Israeli strict treatment against the inmates. Following the recent jailbreak of six inmates from the high-security Jabu prison, Israeli regime keeps practicing inhumane policies and increasing abuse against Palestinian detainees.
We are here to send this message to our prisoners that we won't leave them alone in this battle against the Israeli regime. We won't remain silent over the violations of the rights of our inmates in Israeli jails. The international community should make an urgent action to provide protection for our prisoners.
According to the Palestinian Prisoners Club, dozens of Palestinian detainees from Islamic Jihad have begun their open-ended hunger strike on Wednesday, protesting the Israeli violations and torture inside jails.
Following the heroic escape operation by six inmates, the Israeli regime began to intensify its inhumane torturing policies against our brothers, especially the Islamic Jihad members. Our prisoners have started their hunger strike protesting the inhumane policies of the Israeli regime.
In his speech, the Secretary General of Islamic Jihad, Ziyad al-Nakhala, announced the movement's readiness to respond firmly against the Israeli violations of prisoners' rights, even if this leads to a new round of violence.
We are here today to support our prisoners who have begun their hunger strike. We call on the international community to stop these violations. We warn the Israeli regime that it will face a firm response if these punitive measures are not stopped. Israel is responsible for the lives of our detainees.
About 400 prisoners who belong to the Islamic Jihad movement have begun their hunger strike with the support of other factions. The strike is in protest of Tel Aviv's inhumane measures against Palestinian prisoners, intensified following the escape of six inmates from a high-security Israeli prison last month. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
R-
relations between the EU and Britain remain at an all-time low. The so-called Northern Ireland Protocol was agreed almost 2 years ago and is a key part of the Brexit deal. Despite having negotiated it, Boris Johnson now says the protocol is not working. The EU has just put forward proposals to alter it.
We have completely turned our rules upside down and inside out to find a solid solution to an outstanding challenge.
Under the changes, checks and controls on goods moving from Britain to Northern Ireland will be reduced by more than half. EU laws will be amended to allow medicines licensed in Britain move freely to Northern Ireland. The EU sees the protocol as essential because it prevents border controls between Ireland, which is a member of the bloc, and Northern Ireland, which is part of the UK.
The Good Friday Agreement has to be preserved and no return to a hard border. The British have to work that out with ourselves here in Europe and with Ireland, but that has to be a bottom line for us.
Since Brexit, anti-EU political parties have been established in almost every one of the bloc's 27 member states.
We're being dragged into an EU army. They're imposing laws and regulations upon us which hurt the Irish economy. And now the corporate tax regime, they're after us for that. So Ireland, as things move forward, the benefits are reducing.
Analysts say the fallout from Brexit could also spell big trouble for the United Kingdom. There's growing support in Northern Ireland for a referendum on a United Ireland. Meanwhile, the Scottish National Party is waiting in the wings to call a second independence referendum that could very well see the breakup of the United Kingdom. EU officials are currently in London to try and avert an all-out trade war between the bloc and Britain. EU Commissioner Sefcovic will travel there on Friday to meet his opposite number, British Brexit Minister David Frost. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Beirut has once again been mired by violence. This time the violence was one-sided. At least 6 people were killed and 60 others wounded after gunmen shot at peaceful protesters in El Tayuni roundabout in Beirut. The Lebanese army deployed heavily to contain the area and clear it from any armed presence. The Lebanese interior minister stressed that the incident of sniper fire is unacceptable.
We didn't have any intelligence that such an issue will occur. The organizers of the protests had confirmed that the protest was peaceful. The problem began when the first sniper bullet was shot. It was clearly a sniper fire since the wounds were in the head and the martyrs were all from one side.
Hezbollah and the Amal movement in a joint statement accused the Lebanese Forces Party of attempting to drag the country into civil unrest, calling on its supporters to show self-restraint. What started as a peaceful protest turned into a massacre against unarmed protesters, whose only crime was denouncing what they see as an unfair and politicized probe into the Beirut port explosion. The popular protest was in tandem with a sit-in by experts at law who demanded that current judge prosecutor in charge of the Beirut port explosion investigation be either removed or that he works by the standards of impartiality, as stipulated in legal standards.
We support accountability against anyone who is in authority and is accused of mismanagement, and they should bear all legal allegations. However, this should be done through the principle of a transparent investigation to uncover the truth and in respect of the Constitution and Lebanese laws and reputation. These victims of the port blast and their families are our families, and we want to uncover the truth more than they do.
Judge Tariq Bitar, the judicial investigator into the Beirut port blast, was accused by several members of the Lebanese parliament of being selective and political in his charges.
There's clear partiality in selecting the individuals he wants to take to court. There were 12 ministers who were in those portfolios. Then why did he only choose 4 from one political group? Why did he select 1 prime minister from 3 prime ministers? Why is the judicial system insulting the legislation council? There's a law that stipulates that members of parliament and ministers are tried in the parliament and not in the judicial council.
Bitar was notified on Monday of a lawsuit regarding his neutrality in the investigation, putting the probe on hold. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
opening a defense exhibition in Pyongyang, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un maintained the arms on display provide deterrence, and that it's the United States and South Korea which engage in destabilizing and threatening behavior. Their hypocritical attitude and the U.S. tacit sponsorship continue to damage inter-Korean relations, and their unlimited dangerous attempts to strengthen military capability are disrupting the balance of power in the region, aggravating military instability. North Korea has recently restarted ballistic missile testing, while South Korea has undertaken a massive arms buildup of advanced new planes, ships, submarines, and missiles, with U.S. assistance. Activists suggest dialogue is needed to cool tensions.
When negotiations with North Korea were held, North Korea at least stopped nuclear tests and missile development. A dialogue channel should be opened as soon as possible. To do this, the U.S. should present at least some specific proposals.
The U.S. says there needs to be strong enforcement of existing sanctions on North Korea, although it will meet, quote, unconditionally. Some argue sanctions on Pyongyang need to be reviewed at least. South Korean officials have been more assertive in calling for a new approach from the U.S. According to North Korean state media, leader Kim Jong-un also said North Korea's military might does not target South Korea, and that there should not be another war pitting the Korean people against each other. The 1950-53 Korean War ended in an armistice, not a peace treaty. And South Korean President Moon Jae-in seeks an end-of-war declaration before he leaves office next spring. Frank Smith, Seoul.
In October 2018, a liter of fuel in diesel-dominated France hit €1.53. And for the next 7 months, every Saturday in Paris was a war zone of state repression. The price of diesel gas has just surpassed that all-time record, and many wonder if a return of the yellow vests is now around the corner. After the unprecedented corona lockdowns, diesel, petrol, natural gas, electricity, and prices in general continue to soar worldwide. Inflation in France has just accelerated to the highest rate in 10 years. Western leaders continue to insist the inflation is temporary, but many in France say the economic tension is undeniable.
I would very much like Macron to recognize that the French cannot live with this type of inflation. I normally budget €60 to fill up my car, but today I paid €80. All these price increases in so many areas are a real catastrophe for the French.
Gasoline taxes are regressive taxes because they place the same costs on rich and poor alike. 60% of France's gasoline costs are due to taxation. Many drivers wonder if the right-wing government of Emmanuel Macron is prepared to ease this winter's burden on the average household by making the wealthy and big business pay a fair share. As cold weather nears, a 250% increase in natural gas is forcing European governments to take last-minute action, including caps to corporate profits in left-leaning Spain. France's government is set to announce a small one-time payment for only the poorest households to combat energy costs, which show no sign of easing. France uses the third most natural gas in Europe. The persistent price rises and entrenched unemployment may upend Western plans to finally end quantitative easing and zero interest rate policies, which have produced record economic inequality. Those policies and the disastrous corona recession may have already set the stage for the next economic era across the West, dreaded stagflation. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Around 90% of Portugal's population is now vaccinated. In Bulgaria, the figure is just 22%. Both are members of the EU, but in countries like Bulgaria and Romania, people do not trust what they're being told about the vaccines. Senior European Commission officials attended a meeting of EU health ministers on Tuesday.
My main messages today continue: vaccinate, vaccinate, vaccinate. the difficulties that some member states are currently facing with COVID-19 cases at record high and extreme pressure on hospitals is a stark reminder of this.
Critics say EU health authorities are putting the bloc's vaccination strategy in peril by not giving a clear message on the benefit of booster vaccines. For example, here is what the European Medicines Agency has been saying.
So it's not a strong recommendation as sometimes we do when we really see the need of a booster in the overall population.
The Eurozone economy is already at breaking point due to the pandemic. A conference in Brussels has been discussing the growing problem of long-term unemployment.
It's like a car. If you let a car that is not used for many time in your garage, in your storage, it doesn't work like before. But it doesn't mean that it cannot be recovered at the full of their potential. But this is the responsibility of the government on that.
Gas and electricity prices are soaring in the 19-nation Eurozone, adding to economic uncertainty. But gas and electricity costs aren't the only concerns.
Oil, but also other commodities, and certain commodities like metal need a lot of energy to be produced, so there's a direct link.
And there is a direct link between health and the economy. At their meeting, EU ministers pledged to donate 500 million COVID-19 vaccines to less well-off countries before the middle of next year. Aid agencies insist the EU has a moral duty to keep this promise. Health authorities and economists say the move is in the bloc's own interest in the context of trying to prevent the virus from mutating. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
With Lebanon plunging into darkness as two main power stations barely function, Hezbollah Secretary General called on the government to bring on a complete solution to electricity blackouts.
We need to have a drastic solution to the electricity issue, build new power plants, solve the problems in the current power plants. There are several proposals on the table from various countries in the East and the West. If you don't want from the East, then take proposals of the Western countries. Unless there is an American veto and the Americans are prohibiting you. Tell that to the Lebanese people honestly.
Nasrallah uncovered that the Lebanese government has even turned down offers from countries like Germany and France for fear of U.S. sanctions. He urged the Lebanese government to seek a waiver.
There is a new proposal given by Iran's foreign minister in Beirut a couple of days ago. He said Iran is ready to build two power plants and provide a very good amount of fuel. Give him an answer. Seek a sanctions waiver. For us, the U.S. is an enemy. We can expect anything from an enemy, but if you consider it a friend and a confidant, then fine. Ask this beloved friend, whom you believe has humanity, to make an exception like Iraq and Afghanistan.
Small businesses have been struggling and say they are experiencing what they call a slow death to make ends meet. What this man used to do using electricity, he's now doing with his own hands.
We used to see the electricity for 30 minutes or so, but now nothing. This area used to be a busy area. Now all the work and shops have shut down. Electricity is everything in my work. Now I'm working manually using a saw. I even stopped a private generator because I can't afford it.
Those who can afford it are turning to private generators. Rabia is the owner of one of the private generators south of Beirut. Before the import of Iranian fuel, the bill cost a fortune.
We suffered so much before, especially when we had to raise prices. It's always the people who have to pay the heavy price because of the black market. We thank God and we thank Syed Hassan and the Islamic Republic who launched this initiative and saved us from the dog, and saved the people from paying a very high bill.
Alamana Petroleum is selling the Iranian diesel for almost half the official price, with the subsidies lifted. While the leader of the resistance did declare that Hezbollah will be donating and selling Iranian fuel for the second month, he also stressed that this is only a temporary solution.
On top of the socio-economic crisis in Lebanon lies an almost total collapse of the electricity crisis. Hezbollah's Secretary General has called on the government to prioritize the issue in order to put the country on the track of a drastic solution. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Iran's major nuclear facilities have been targeted by cruise missiles. Iranian air defense says it has successfully foiled the attack using homegrown missile systems. This is the scenario for a massive military drill held over a 500,000 square kilometer area in central Iran, codenamed Defenders of Velayat Skies. The air defense exercise